college basketball, Marquette will host Seton Hall tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Tuesday, January 9th. Cloudy and mild, some afternoon fog. Today's high 39. New numbers are in. Wind from the southwest at 3, 27 degrees in Racine, 24 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 10 and a half minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The next American Experience documentary is a film you absolutely cannot miss. It is titled Into the Amazon. And the title refers to a remarkable journey which almost cost the life of Theodore Roosevelt. This is a journey which he took in early 1914, part of an expedition exploring an essentially uncharted and largely unknown river in the heart of the Amazon jungle of Brazil. And anybody who reads about the presidents and, for instance, reads about the exceptionally complex and energetic life of Theodore Roosevelt probably has read at least passing reference to this trip, which left Theodore Roosevelt very ill, sapped up some of his vigor, and he died just several years later, never quite the same man as he was before he entered this jungle and began what turned out to be an ordeal that nearly cost him his life. It is so great to have this remarkable new documentary film that tells the story of this extraordinary journey in such remarkable detail. Into the Amazon comes to us on American Experience, and it is the handiwork of course, a whole team of documentarians, but at the helm, the director and writer, John Maggio. And you have probably already experienced his fine work all over the place, including at least two different American Experience episodes, Kinsey and Billy the Kid. He is the winner of a whole host of different awards, and this is just the latest of his many exploits. He is the principal producer and director with ARC Media. Again, this film is titled Into the Amazon. And John Maggio, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
So whose idea was it? Was this a story you already knew something about, or did somebody come to you saying, this is a great story that needs to be told in a great film?
You know, I wish it had been originally my idea, and as often is the case with American Experience, Mark Sammels, the executive producer of that incredible series, which is, I think, in its 30th year now, approached me a couple of years ago about the idea. They had received a grant from the National Endowment of Humanities. He was just sort of lit upon the idea. I believe it was part of the Ken Burns biography, a very small part of Burns' biography on TR. And it just seemed like a great story that deserved its own film. So when he approached me, the initial idea was to try and go and, you know, make this film in Brazil to retrace Teddy Roosevelt's steps, and I just lit upon it. It really excited me.
Hmm. What are the resources that were available to you in terms of coming to such a rich, comprehensive understanding about this trip, why it was undertaken, and exactly what happened day by day? In a sense, what survives, which allows you and others to know so much about this trip and what ensued on it?
Yeah, well, there were a few key sources. Theodore Roosevelt, when he went on these kinds of adventures, you know, we know about his grand safari of Africa and his time in the Badlands and all across the West and as a rough rider. For some of them, he would sign a deal with Scribner's Magazine to write about the adventure. And so that he did this for this adventure when he went down to. He was originally asked to go on a speaking tour of South America. And then he had planned, the original plan was to do a kind of quieter trip up the Paraguay River on a riverboat, and sort of in the custom of how he was used to doing explorations, not very rigorous. They would try to get some samples for the New York Natural History Museum, which he often did, bag some new bird species. He brought a naturalist with him. So the idea was that he would just sort of write of what he saw in the Amazon, which at that time was still and is largely today the last frontier. So I had his pieces for Scribner's and some of his early notes and journal entries about the trip. The second and no less important source was the naturalist George Cherry, who traveled with Theodore Roosevelt. He too kept a journal, a very detailed journal. You know, there'd be some days missing, you know, so you had to kind of piece that together from other places. But there's a gentleman in Chicago named Joseph Ornick who wrote a book called My Last Chance to Be a Boy, which was how Theodore Roosevelt described this adventure for himself. He has figured it was his last chance, his last great adventure. And what that is essentially he went through George Cherry's journals, which were all scribbled, and he transcribed them. So I had a nice written report of everything that happened. And then the third source was Kermit Roosevelt, who was Theodore Roosevelt's son, who joined him on the expedition as a way to kind of look out for him. He had been engaged to be married shortly before he went on this trip, and he had these letters that he wrote to his betrothed, whose name was Belle Willard, from a prominent family in Washington. So I had those letters to call upon. So, you know, it's actually a large amount of material to sift through to kind of piece the story together.
Right. In addition to that, I was really amazed at how many photographs there are.
Yeah.
And even it appears, I mean, quite a lot of this is dramatic recreation, but there are certain moments that appear to be authentic film footage of maybe at least the preliminary portion of this trip. Just tell us about the photographic and videographic legacy that survives this this journey that you could utilize in your film.
Yeah, so there was a couple things. There were a number of photographs. Kermit, often when he was on trips with TR, would act as the kind of group cameraman. So he took a fair number of photos that you'll see in the film. And there was they had a provisioner named Anthony Fiala, who was it's very funny. This is a kind of an ill-fated trip. Theodore Roosevelt did not pay too much attention to the planning of it. And one of the planners was much more accustomed to exploring in the Arctic. So this was going to be a new adventure for him, but he was keen on shooting it in 16-millimeter film. And so he also took some photographs, and he took some early footage of the trip. But he was a casualty of to get to the headwaters of what was called the Rio de Dúvida, the River of Doubt, which is the river they ultimately went down. This is the unknown river. They had to go overland, a very treacherous trek overland. And by the time they got to the headwaters, they realized they were so low on rations and that not everybody in the expedition would be able to make the journey down the river. So they sent some people back and then down alternate rivers. And they just couldn't carry all the camera equipment that they had brought. And point of fact, some of it was lost when Fiala left. So the actual trip down the river of doubt was never memorialized on film. However, about a year or so, a couple of years after that, another explorer decided to sort of retrace Teddy Roosevelt's journey. And I believe that was actually quite a bit. It was probably, I think, in 1932. I'm not quite sure. But he went down and he took film equipment and did a lot of filming. So I've kind of intercut those two so you get a sense of the actual river and the waterfalls and the rapids and the things that they were encountering. So it's a combination of those things. It's sadly scant. I wish the camera, the film had sort of survived the journey and that the cameraman could have gone. But as you've seen in the film, and I don't want to give it away to the jury listeners, it was such a treacherous journey. It would have been impossible to hold on to that camera equipment.
Oh, absolutely. That's for certain. And it's great that even a few little snatches of film survive, as well as some of these intriguing photographs. So, as I already mentioned, much of this journey is, in a sense, dramatically recreated or theatrically recreated, however we want to say that. I would love to have you kind of describe the means by which you went about doing that and what kind of challenges that posed very specifically to you as the filmmaker.
Sure. Well, our original intention was to, as I said, to retrace his route on the actual River of Doubt, but the logistics of doing so are not that much different than they were in 1914, believe it or not. We would have had to take a couple charter flights from Manaus to get into that area. It's still largely undeveloped. There's a birding sanctuary there that is open only part of the year, and it is controlled by what has become a really violent situation between the Sintalarga and Brazilians and other tribes along the river over diamond mining and deforestation and things. So it's a hostile environment. We may not have gotten the rights to actually be on parts of the river. So it became a non-starter almost as soon as we started to investigate it. So we went upriver. We actually went about a few hours upriver, up the Rio Negro, to a tributary called the Arayu River, which had a lot of the same geographic similarities to the River of Doubt, the black water. It was a flooded, the time we went was just after the rainy season, so the river was swollen and quite flooded. And at times was like, just like it was a sort of highway going through a tunnel of jungle. It really had a very sort of cinematic effect. And it was close enough to civilization, whereas if anybody got hurt, we were a helicopter flight to safety. So, and the idea was we flew in a 25-person crew, and then we hired a lot of local Brazilians, many of them indigenous Indians to that area, to act as animal wranglers. They carved about 6 or 7, 15, 16, 18-foot dugouts that they used, and we used as part of the recreations. They were incredible. They acted very much as the guides that Roosevelt had to us. So I felt very, we encountered all the same kind of the conditions that Roosevelt encountered in 1914, which brought me so much closer to the story in a way. And I really relied on these guys to get us through. And we had a fair number of accidents. It rains every day for about an hour, no matter what. It could be, beautiful sky, and all of a sudden the torrential rain pour would come down. And we've got hundreds of thousands of dollars of camera equipment and lenses and various things. You can tell from the film that I brought down a second unit, which was just for overhead drone shooting to kind of give you the scale. I wanted it to feel like the expedition were just ants going through this massive landscape. The Amazon is so vast. I mean, it's the size of the lower 48 states of North America. I mean, it's such a huge forest that I wanted to be able to sort of recreate that. So we tried as much as possible to put you in the shoes of the experience that Roosevelt had and all the men had going down the river, and experienced a few hairy moments of our own in the process.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with John Maggio, talking about his latest work for American Experience, a superb film called Into the Amazon, which traces the harrowing story of Theodore Roosevelt and other explorers who probed into the heart of the Amazon rainforest, charting a river that was largely unknown to anyone in the outside world, named then the River of Doubt. And this film tells that story of that journey, which Theodore Roosevelt was very, very lucky to survive. By the way, John Maggio, I wanted to ask you about the fact that you are, I believe, both the head writer and the director of this wonderful film. I wonder if you could just explain what those two titles mean and the way in which they both sort of overlap with each other. Help us understand the ways in which you were playing both of those roles and what they each had to do with the other.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's such an, you know, it's obviously a very collaborative process. I mean, I had a wonderful cameraman named Tim Craig, who's based in London, who gives the film this kind of lush cinematic quality, which was just extraordinary. That's something I knew as a director that I wanted. I wanted it to, I made a decision early on that I wanted to shoot in black and white, because I felt that a lot of, you know, when you're in the Amazon, it's just an endless amount of green, and it's almost a static kind of thing. And what you get with black and white are these deep blacks and these kind of, you know, a darkness and a contrast that I felt like was more a kind of impression of what the expedition experienced. The sort of silence of the jungle we talk about quite a bit that really spooked them. So I wanted it to have that feel. So as a director, you make those kinds of decisions. I knew I wanted it to be cinematic, and American Experience gave me the resources to sort of make it a big, make the film have a big cinematic feeling. As a writer, the process is so iterative. You know, as we were talking earlier, I try to find all the extant written sources about the journey, find as much information. I talk to experts even before I do any interviewing. We pre-interview, and I put together what we call a shooting script. And that helps orient, because, you know, everything is so expensive to shoot. You don't want to waste a frame because, you know, dollars are flying out of your pockets as you're thinking about this. So I really try to have a very measured, very controlled sense of what the story is and what the message is that I want to get out. And early on, I realized as a writer that the story was this great conflict of these two great men, Theodore Roosevelt, of course, but also Candido Rondon, who was, as we say in the film, the Lewis and Clark of Brazil. He was this incredible explorer. He's still a revered, beloved hero to Brazil, in many respects, even today. So I look for moments where, as a writer, I look for moments where the narrative and the themes that I want to emerge, you know, will pop out. And then I do all the interviews, and again, you come back, and I create what I call a radio cut, which is that there's no pictures. It's just my experts talking, and then I find out where I need to make connections and writing and kind of flow. So it just, and that process never ends. I mean, I'm writing right up to the very end. You know, even after I've shot all of the sort of dramatic recreations, I come back, and the writing is always sort of, you know, I try to pull the writing back and let the experts kind of do as much of the talking as possible. But there are moments when you want to tease out some emotion, so you have to sort of maybe rely on yourself to write something, or you turn to a quote from one of the journals. So it's a balancing act. You know, you want to sort of always kind of stay just ahead of the audience and, you know, just keep the drama taut. But it took a while. You know, it's like an 18-month process.
Mm. Well, it's amazing, and the final product simply speaks for itself. And I'm happy to have a little better sense of the various responsibilities which you shouldered in the making of this film. One thing I appreciate about the film is that it not only charts for us this journey down the River of Doubt, but you also take a few moments at one point in the film to share with us part of the backstory of Theodore Roosevelt. By no means his whole backstory. I mean, for instance, we actually hear remarkably little about his presidency from 1901 to 1909. He's certainly referred to as a former president, and this journey down this river in the Amazon comes just a couple years after his failed attempt to win a third term as a third-party candidate. But But what you really are looking back at, much more than his political career, is his childhood, which in so many ways stands at complete odds with the vigorous adult man that he was to become. Explain to our listeners what Theodore Roosevelt was like as a young child growing up, and then the remarkable transformation which he was somehow able to effect.
Yeah, no, he was a very, very sickly child living in Manhattan with his family. He had asthma. He was very frail. He was very underdeveloped. Not his mind. His mind was always very sharp. But he just physically didn't seem to be able to kind of keep up. You know, he didn't play sports. His father would try all sorts of different remedies. At one point, he used to smoke cigars in a closet. All sorts of crazy remedies, which seem counterintuitive, but something to sort of stop this cycle of asthma that he was in. And then at some point, it is a great moment where that's often repeated about T.R.'s biography. His father says, you know, you have to make your body. You know, when he was a teenager, he sort of laid down the gauntlet and said, your mind is sharp, but your body needs to be remade. And it really set off a lifelong journey for T.R. to live what he called the strenuous life. And what's interesting to me and how it fuels his relationship to the natural world is that he wanted to seek a mastery of the natural world. He had so little control in his physical space as a child that I think, you know, the ideas of hunting and boating and camping and shooting and all of these things made him want to, you know, it gave him a sense of control, that he could somehow control the natural world in his own way. And you see that throughout his life, you know, his safaris in Africa and various places. So that theme of the sort of the crippled, practically crippled young man emerging through college as this robust outdoorsman defines who he is, and it defines some of the reasons why he took this trip. And I think that, you know, all around the world he had seemed to sort of conquer. He was a big game hunter in Africa and in the Badlands. You know, he conquered so much. But when he went to the Amazon, it's sort of the message of the story, nature wins. You know, he couldn't. It nearly took his life. You know, it nearly crippled him again. And it did. It snatched away, as his sister says at the end of the film, you know, at least 10 years of his life the Amazon took from him. So I think it, in a way, he met his match in the Amazon, and I think that was why I focused on that particular part of his biography, more so than the politics of his life.
One of the things that was a very significant contributing factor to why this trip ended up being so difficult and why so many things went wrong was because it was supposed to be a very different trip than the trip or expedition that was ultimately undertaken. Explain what the original intention was, the original plan, and under what circumstances that plan shifted into something drastically different and into something else for which Theodore Roosevelt and his party were rather ill-equipped.
Well, the original plan, I mean, he was originally invited to go on a speaking tour, as I had mentioned earlier, from a museum in Argentina, which he then built out to be a speaking tour of all of South America. And where the politics do come in, which I don't really deal with in the film, was that to go to South America for Theodore Roosevelt was a bit of an adventure to begin with, because he was not that well-liked. He was seen as an imperialist for what he had done in the Panama, for the Panama Canal, and for his relationship in the Philippines. And, you know, he wasn't, by the populace, a super well-liked person. So I think for him, just even going down there was going to be an adventure. But he figured while he went down there, he would do a hunting and collecting trip up the Paraguay River, which, you know, runs into the Amazon, but is a much more settled. He was going to be on a steamboat, and he could shoot some things from the water and maybe go on a hunt. And, you know, what he was used to, his previous safaris in Africa were very well accommodated. He had hundreds of people literally carrying him on their backs. He was never far from a train. So he was accustomed to kind of roughing it. We call it glamping today in a way. I mean, it's still pretty rough, but That's what this trip was going to be. So they provisioned for that kind of trip. They brought bacon and wines and chocolates and everything, all sort of creature comforts from home. They even brought some Canadian, 19-foot Canadian canoes. So that's what they were planning for. But when Roosevelt started his trip, he landed in Rio de Janeiro, and he met Candido Rondon, who was then Brazil's greatest living explorer. He was running a telegraph wire from Rio all the way through the Amazon. That was his mission, to sort of connect the entire country of Brazil. And in a way, it was Brazilian manifest destiny. And he challenges Roosevelt upon meeting him. He says, you know, if you really want to go on, you really want to do some real exploring, why don't we go down this river that I've gotten to the headwaters. It's called the Rio da Dúvida, the River of Doubt, because no one's ever been down it. No, Rondon had some ideas where it might go, but really had never been charted. And I think that T.R., being who he was, couldn't turn down the challenge, you know, and decided, okay, let's do this. And not having really given his expedition any time to kind of pivot and reprovision. So they enter into the Amazon with this incredibly intrepid explorer who is used to living off of nothing but berries and honey from the beehives that he sees, and he's a truly intrepid explorer. These guys enter this equation now, the Americans and that team, and they're just overwhelmed. They have to scuttle many of their provisions. So in this month-long journey just to get to the headwaters of the River Doubt, they're decimated. Malaria has set in, dysentery has set in. Many of them are feverish. They're very hungry. Rondon cut off many of the rations. And it was just a total wake-up call. It was really quite startling.
Mm. You mentioned the fact that no one from the outside, I mean, even really nobody from, let's say, the more civilized portions of Brazil, that's maybe an offensive way to put it, nobody from the outside had ever traveled down this so-called River of Doubt. So in other words, nobody knew exactly where this river went. Nobody knew where it would end up. So nobody had any way of knowing just how long a journey this could potentially be. With all of those unknowns, it seems, in a sense, like the utmost foolishness to undertake this kind of journey without knowing at least those kind of basic facts. And yet, that's something we in the modern world have to try to wrap our heads around, that this is part of what the era of exploration was all about. Exactly. Absolutely. These kind of death-defying trips.
Absolutely. And Roosevelt really wanted to be part of that. You know, we say that in the film. You know, there were we had just sort of, you know, Shackleton had traveled through Antarctica, the North, the poles had been discovered. You know, people were putting their country's flags all over and their names all over the map, you know, the sort of physical geography of this world. And Roosevelt really wanted to be part of that, you know, and this seemed to be his last sort of chance to be considered one of these sort of intrepid explorers. And in fact, today, you know, the river is now known as the Rio Roosevelt. I mean, he did eventually get down. But he was with a man who knew the Amazon better than any man alive. You know, I mean, obviously the indigenous people that he encountered along the way in his past, in his Brazilian sort of manifest destiny, he met people that obviously knew the land and knew their parts of the land, but they were very tribal. You know, so he would sort of get to know them and kept them in place, and then would sort of move on and use their aid. And as we say, as you see in the film, he had a very different ideas about how you acculturate people into a kind of Brazilian identity than we did in this country, you know, with relocation and considering native peoples wards of the state, as Theodore Roosevelt did. So there's that sort of tension going on. But yes, I mean, Rondon had a kind of vague idea of where this river would let out. He figured it would connect with the Madeira River and then maybe up to the Rio Negro. And we don't know for certain. You know, the rubber tappers were mercenary, you know, so there were lots of European rubber tappers all over the Brazilian Amazon at this point. So there may have been some rubber tappers who kind of knew some parts of the river, but what they discovered was it was so treacherous that it would have been impossible for anybody to go up this river. As they are going down, and it's not until, you know, about 450 miles later that they actually discover that there were rubber tappers way, way down. But that was a very treacherous 400-mile journey just to get to that point,
right?
As we talk about in the film.
Right. And, of course, we are in no way going to reveal all of the specifics of this journey. We will leave that for people to explore in your film. Just a couple of other quick questions, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most intriguing themes in the film surrounds the very sharp difference of opinion between Theodore Roosevelt and Colonel Rondon when this journey all but grinds to a halt. And part of the impasse is that Colonel Rondon is anxious to do very careful surveying of this river. In his mind, that's the whole point of this journey. And for Theodore Roosevelt and probably those with him in his party, they are feeling like that meticulous approach to surveying this river is part of what's getting us in trouble. It's taking too much time, and we're not going to survive this. And it's so interesting because, at least the way you present it in the film, I find myself completely split between those two opinions. That is, I really see the point of Mr. Roosevelt. I really see the point of Mr. Rondon. This is just one of those sort of implacable conflicts with a lot of truth on both sides. I wonder if that's how it felt to you, or if you took great pains to make sure not to paint one or the other as sort of the villain in this particular conflict.
Well, no, yeah, I mean, I am just communicating what we discovered in the journals, and there was a lot of consternation in the journal entries about, especially with Cherry, who was like, let's just get on with this trip, you know, like enough with this mapping, you know, because Cherry was keeping very close tabs on what the rations were, and, you know, at a certain point, you know, I don't want to give it away, but in the film, you realize, like, they're going to run out of food very quickly. So I was very much aware that, you know, as Roosevelt said in the film, great men don't waste time on details. And what Rondon says back to him, what does he say? He says, I am not a great man. And this is all about details. This is what matters to me. Because as I said, he was essentially mapping the new nation of Brazil, you know, and the far reaches that had never really fully been understood. Now, Rondon was born in that area. He was part Bororo Indian. So to him, this was a serious mission. This was a matter of science. He was a man of science. And so the idea that they would just kind of rush through just to quote-unquote survive, because he was fine, which is the other remarkable thing, is that all of the Americans for sure are falling apart. I mean, Roosevelt lost over 50 pounds. And in many of the camaradas, the aides that Rondon had collected to help them get down the river, the locals, they were all famished. Everyone, but, you know, Rondon is always like in a kind of starched white uniform somehow and just an absolute machine. So to him, he had the very tricky, he was in a very tricky position, because here he is. One of the reasons I think he got the opportunity to even map this river was because he was with the former president of the United States, one of the most famous men in the world, easily. So he felt both that was an opening with the Brazilian government to give him the funding to map this river, but also he had the responsibility. He could not let Theodore Roosevelt die in the middle of this jungle. Mm. Or say bad things about Brazil when he got out of the jungle. So he was in a bit of a precarious position. So you see him being obstinate for a while. You know, at one point, Kermit Roosevelt, who ended up being his helper in the survey, got out 114 times in one day, you know, putting up his siding pole, and Rondon would do these very detailed measurements. So you can imagine they were only go like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 miles at a time in a given day, and they had hundreds of miles to go. So I just wanted to play it as the facts, you know, as what we discerned from the journals as it was. And that emerged quite quickly. You start to realize that there's this problem, and it's getting hotter and hotter as they go down there. You see that it's going to end in a conflict in some way.
Right.
But I respect Rondon as a scientist. I mean, you know, how can you not? You know, in that day and age, and what I've come to learn is those maps are unbelievable detailed, and given what rudimentary stuff he was working with in those conditions, turns out those maps are still the ones people rely on.
Right, and it's an impressive feat, that's for sure. And chances are that at least some kind of rudimentary discussion occurred at the outset about, well, why don't you do this trip instead? We'll be surveying this uncharted river. And that probably sounded great to Mr. Roosevelt, not fully understanding just what the ramifications of that might be. And probably Colonel Rondon himself might not have even realized just how perilous a journey this was ultimately going to be.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's interesting, too. But Rondon, you know, he was such a smart man. I mean, he was not... he was aware of the geopolitics of the whole situation, and you see at some point on the actual journey they had, he'd already had plaques made that he, you know, if he came across a certain tributary or something, he was going to name one the Rio Kermit, for instance, you know, and at the very end when they finally reach a rescue boat that was at the headwaters from the Madeira River, he had a plaque called the Rio Roosevelt. You know, so he was shrewd, you know, he knew that how to stroke Roosevelt in a way that would stroke his ego and kind of keep him going when the going got tough. And it was a stroke of genius, I got to say. They're both playing a game. You know, I think Roosevelt felt like, I'm going to pretend like Rondon is in charge, but really I am the man, as he always was. You know, and Rondon was playing the same game. You know, Rondon was going to let the great President Roosevelt believe that he was in charge, but in reality, he was the only one that could get him out.
Mm. And, of course, stirred into that, although we won't take the time today to talk about it, is the presence of Kermit Roosevelt, one of Theodore Roosevelt's sons, and, in a sense, the evolving role that he ends up playing. I want to ask you about something else that was kind of a big surprise to me. And we won't go into too many specifics, but one of the most pressing, urgent concerns was the fact that because this journey was going so much more slowly than was expected, their rations were not really sufficient for the journey, and there was a real fear that they would simply run out of food. And one of the reasons why they undertook the journey without lavish rations on hand is because they made an assumption about what they would be able to do along the way to supplement their rations, and that proved to be all but impossible. Explain this conundrum, which nearly proved to be a fatal one.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting part of the story because it speaks to a failure, really, kind of almost on Rondon's part to anticipate the lack of food they would find in the forest. What happened was that they were traveling through the by the time they actually reached the River of Doubt, it was the rainy season. So the river gets incredibly swollen. And the banks, as you can see in the film from the way we recreated the experience, there no longer is any banks. It's essentially a flooded forest. You know, the river rises. And what that does is that forces any game they would have seen much further away. And it also makes it harder to fish. You know, the piranha are, you know, which you would eat there, are fine because there's so much stuff floating around the water. They're not having a problem, so they're not interested necessarily in eating what you have. And the water gets very murky and black, and so it was a real conundrum for them. Like Rondon had assumed, as he always had, when in the middle of the rainforest, that he would be able to sort of find the provisions he needed. And, you know, and I think also it was a down year. You could survive on the Brazil nuts in the rainforest, but in that particular year it had been a down year for Brazil nuts. So there wasn't even, like, the kind of nuts that Rondon would be used to eating. Those weren't around. So it was just, again, it was a perfect storm, not to overuse an analogy, but a perfect storm of events that led to them really struggling to find sustenance.
Hmm. As we near the end of this film, one has a sense that it was first and foremost an ordeal. And, of course, the heart and soul of the of this story and its intrinsic drama is in the fact that all of these people nearly died, including Theodore Roosevelt himself, which sort of prompts the question, do we have much sense at all that any of this journey was enjoyable in the way that one might hope it was or might have hoped it was going to be as one undertakes such a journey? I mean, do we have much sense, for instance, from the journal entries left behind that the staggering beauty around them was a source of inspiration and pleasure for them, or by and large was anything positive swallowed up in just what was so awful and difficult about this journey?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Roosevelt's stories that he ended up publishing in Scribner's Magazine, in a way, you know, he's such a master of creating his own mythology. And so, you know, it's filled with, like, excruciating detail, but fun detail for any kind of reader who's, you know, in that time was stuck working in the city or something. You know, the idea that you could be transported to this exotic place where, you know, he tells the stories about the snakes they encountered, and the anaconda and the caiman and the bats. You know, there are times where he's like, we've now entered the land of the blood-sucking bats and the piranha, you know, the fish that eat men. All of these stories, you know, get codified in Scribner's Magazine, and it creates this incredibly romantic notion of the explorer and again, burnishing the mythology of Theodore Roosevelt. And he, you know, he does talk about some of the problems that he had personally, but not a whole lot in those Scribner's Magazine articles. Really, he's the hero of the story in many ways. So in that regard, it is burnished in a way that seems like it was a mythical experience. And I think what's true of any frontier, there is that experience of discovery. You know, I think that they did have moments where they were kind of blown away. But, you know, you have to understand, Kermit didn't want to be there to begin with. Kermit had just been engaged. His heart was thousands of miles away to his you feel this aching. We use some of them in the film, and this writing to Belle Willard, his fiance, where he's just, you know, he's just like, I just want this to be over. So I think in a way that blinded Kermit to seeing any of the kind of real beauty that might have existed in front of them. You know, it's interesting to note that we interviewed T.R.'s third great grandson, Tweed Roosevelt, who in the 80s recreated the journey down the river, down almost the whole river. I think they weren't allowed access to certain parts of the river. But he himself describes the sort of brutal landscape that it is, but he describes, you know, also describes some of the amazing beauty there, you know, of the butterflies and the caterpillars and the various things that, yeah, that were really beautiful. So it's really hard to say. We don't know. I mean, Theodore Roosevelt never betrayed exactly what he felt. He was very proud of himself when he got the awards at the National Geographic Museums in Washington, and then later on the Geographic Society, the vaunted Geographic Society in London, that finally believed that he had actually, quote-unquote, discovered a river that was now called the Rio Roosevelt, and he had put together a very forceful presentation to prove to these explorers. So I think he felt part of a club, like he had achieved that. So I think that gave him a great sense of something, that the journey was worth it. But it's really hard to, it's hard to know. It's all sort of couched in mythology. For Rondon, it was business as usual. You know, he turns around remarkably and goes right back into the jungle to continue his, I don't know how you feel, but like when I realized that in the making of the film, it's just, that guy is just an unbelievable human being.
Oh, absolutely. A true hero. 5'3", you tell us, and yet yeah. A man of tremendous stature in every other respect. Let's finish with this, since you just grazed the topic, which I wasn't necessarily going to even raise, but it's so intriguing. I hope you won't mind just talking for a minute or two about the fact that I think, as most of our listeners already knew, Theodore Roosevelt does survive this journey through the Amazon, albeit narrowly. And he survives and returns to America only to find himself the target of some criticism and even thinly veiled ridicule about what this journey actually was and whether or not they actually accomplished anything at all. This is tremendously interesting, and this is something I didn't know anything about. Can you just at least tantalize us with a couple of points about this surprising homecoming for the former president, which ultimately led to the vindication that you just mentioned.
Yeah. Well, yeah, people were really dubious. I mean, you know, there is, in the world of exploration, especially during that time, it was, you had to have, to go on an expedition, it had to be, you know, very certain strictures about what it is you were actually exploring. Was it truly not explored before? Did it exist? Did anybody know about it? Was there any kind of map? And they take it very seriously. You know, I mean, nowadays it's hard to remember. There are so few frontiers left. I would argue that the Amazon still is, in many ways, a frontier. There are still people debate the number, but there are still a number of uncontacted tribes in the Brazilian, in the upper Xingu region of the Brazilian Amazon. So it feels still like that maybe that exists. We're pushing the frontiers of science in many ways, but in physical geography, there are limits. There are a few left, I think. But explorers take it very seriously when you say you've discovered something. And he didn't realize the heat with which he was going to be attacked by the establishment about whether or not he really had. And so he had to make these full-throated presentations, even though, you know, as you'll learn in the film, I mean, his body was decimated, and I don't want to get into too many of the details, but it very nearly took his life. I don't know how he survived. But he still had, you know, because his good character and his honesty was being impugned, he really fought very hard to prove that he had indeed discovered this river. And Rondon, I think, helped him out and wrote affidavits and, you know, shared the maps with him. So he had to go on and put on these displays. And he was eventually vindicated, which was so important to him. You know, it was like his last great fight to be vindicated for this thing that he had in fact discovered a river. The mere fact that he landed where he was and from where he started should have been proof enough that there actually was a river that nobody knew about. But in this, with explorers, it was very, and geographers, it was very important that he make this very detailed explanation. And in a weird way, he was the benefactor of Rondon's painstaking work. You know, had Rondon not done it, it would have been a lot harder to prove that they actually had been on that journey. Hmm. So the story really does come full circle in many ways.
Wow. Well, we leave it to our listeners to watch this spectacular and very moving film as well. It is, again, titled Into the Amazon, chronicling the death-defying journey of a small party of Americans, including former U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt and his son Kermit Roosevelt, exploring a yet uncharted river in the Amazon rainforest and emerging eventually to tell their harrowing tale. A beautifully constructed film written and directed by John Maggio. John Maggio, congratulations. You've done it again. What a wonderful film. And thank you for being so generous with your time and talking about it with me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes.
Thanks. It was my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll be talking about yet another fine documentary film, this one that's going to be showing in movie theaters across the country this Saturday as an HD simulcast from the Metropolitan Opera. It's a documentary film called The Opera House, and it tells the really fascinating and complicated story of the design and construction of the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City at the heart of Lincoln Center, and explores all the ways in which that was an incredibly difficult undertaking. On Thursday, I look forward to speaking with Michael Klickner, who is directing the latest production at the Racine Theatre Guild that opens this weekend, a Tony Award-winning play called Vanya and Sanya and Masha and Steve and it's and Spike. And it is a really terrific play I had the pleasure of seeing on Broadway. And I, for one, am very excited that it's coming to the Theatre Guild this weekend, and we'll be talking with its director on Thursday. On Friday, I'm going to be replaying my interview with the commanding officer of the Great Lakes Naval Base. We had a conversation last year with Captain John Hawkins, and we want to share that conversation with you once again. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock and is archived at WGTD.org. Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at jackandrea.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information.